Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
There's a certain kind of story about China's emergence as one of the world's most powerful political and economic forces, one that suggests that this extraordinary growth sprang directly and exclusively from Deng Xiaoping's opening of the country's economy in the late 20th century. Scott Tong calls it the instant China narrative, and he knows it yields tidy, fascinating stories of rags-to-riches transformation. It's just that those stories leave a lot out. How and why China came late to the Industrial Revolution, how its communist government tried to cut off connections with foreign cultures, and how China changed after what Tong calls the great resumption of robust international relationships. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Scott Tong is a correspondent for the American Public Media radio show Marketplace. And at the end of a 3.5-year posting in Shanghai, he found himself still hungering for a sense of context on China's place in the world and his own family's place in Chinese history. He discovered remarkable parallels between his own family's story with relatives who stayed and those who moved abroad and the development of modern China. Tong shares what he learned in his new book, A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. He joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Scott, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's very good to be with you.
Talk for a minute about the pros and cons of instant China stories.
Oh, well, instant China is it's so tempting when anyone first goes to China for 5 minutes. And we all get what a banker friend of mine called skyscraper syndrome. You go to a fancy place and you think, boy, this is it. This is the story and China is the future. And boy, a whole lot of news stories look kind of like that. I certainly did them myself. The story of a country that in a single generation just kind of propelled itself to a leading place in the world. You know, we need kind of these bumper sticker slogans to kind of understand places far away and complicated realities. But what it doesn't tell us is kind of the longer story. You know, it can look like a miracle that sprang out of nowhere if we don't step back and get a little bit of critical distance. And I didn't have that critical distance when I was in China doing day-to-day stories as a reporter. So after I moved back to the States, I had time to kind of step back and read some of the history books I should have and connect with some of the historical stories in my own family to understand how today's China connects to a previous era of globalization a century ago. And there are some individuals in my family story who were part of that.
You write that you wanted to dig into your family's past because so many people wanted to keep it buried, which is like such the problem of having a journalist in the family, right? But I wonder how, for example, your mother explained why she just would barely speak about her own father.
Her father, my maternal grandfather, is a great illustration of someone who ended up on the wrong side of history, in this case, China's history. And when you're on the wrong side of history, nobody tells yours. Nobody mentioned his name at the table when I was trying to understand the family history. My mother talked a fair bit about her own mother, who has a very interesting story of connecting to American missionaries and being an educated young woman at a very early age, but not much about her father, who was a political prisoner. He was convicted of being a collaborator with the Japanese occupation in China. So even today, that is a hugely shameful part of the story and in the family. So a lot of people who have relatives from the darker side of history, they just won't talk about that person. I think we in the United States, you know, we value open kitchens and transparency, and, you know, we're kind of these oversharing people in the world in a way. That doesn't travel. It certainly doesn't travel much in China, where shame and avoiding shame is very important. So when I was starting this book project, my mother said, you know, I don't think I want some veto authority over some of the content and to not tell some of the story. We ended up learning a lot of her father's story and why he was arrested and the work he did during the occupation. And a lot of our assumptions about resistance and collaboration were overturned. And I went to the labor camp where he was eventually sent and where he died in the late 50s. And after bringing back all the information that I learned, not just about my grandfather, but about that whole generation of Chinese prisoners, my mother said, you know, this is an important story to tell. So she, in a way, granted me permission to be able to tell the story.
She spent a lot of her life trying to leave China behind, and you've spent much of your life returning to your family's ancestral home for professional opportunities, but also just to understand this place that had an impact on the people that you love.
You know, I think for me, I came from a position, I was born in the United States, and I was able to kind of go back and understand the Chinese story and the family story for the first time. I think a lot of people who are born in mainland China, people like my mother, you know, they have memories of, very tragic memories of what happened then, and memories that have been suppressed. It was not long ago that China went through the worst famine in recorded history and went through these political witch hunts. One of my relatives was forced in that period. It's known as the Cultural Revolution. She was forced to stand, because she was politically stained as well, to stand in the winter underneath a tree so the icicles could drip down inside of her collar, you know, and forced to stand there for hours. And every family has these kinds of stories that a lot of people, for understandable reasons, would rather leave behind. But not just as a journalist, but as a foreigner to China, as a Chinese American, these stories are new to me, and they're important to tell. And where I come from is, you know, a lot of these stories, if they're not told to us and to the rest of the world, they're going to they're going to die when that generation does. And a lot of those stories are already gone.
How willing are people in China today who have memories of this kind of persecution and suffering, how willing are they to talk about that?
At the kitchen table, they're very willing to talk about it in a private setting. So there's a real distinction between a private setting and a public setting in Chinese society. So I spent hours and hours with my father's brother. My father got out as a child, just as the communists were coming, and his brother got left behind. And I wanted to know the story of him and others who got left behind. And he would tell a lot of these stories of how he suffered and how he was sent down to the countryside as a youth during the Cultural Revolution. So his family was punished. He felt a lot of it himself. Those stories, I think a lot of people are willing to tell in private. When I told him that this is going to be a central chapter in the book, I wanted it to be a central chapter in the book, he said, well, you can't write a lot of this shameful stuff to the public. And so we had a bit of a negotiation. I told my uncle, you know, this book is going to be in English, at least at the start. It's going to be read by a bunch of Americans. And he said, well, I have friends in America. I said, really? You have a lot of friends in the United States? And he said, six. So that's the power of shame, of not wanting to tell very publicly these stories that all Chinese families have.
All right, so let's step back here a little bit and talk about your father's family. Mm-hmm. Your father's grandfather left this not-so-cosmopolitan village in search of an education. He found that in Japan. He had a really extraordinary life.
He did. So that is on my father's side of the family tree. My last name is Tong. So he comes from the village where everyone's last name is Tong, in a kind of a forlorn part of eastern China in Jiangsu province. And he was a scholar in the late 1800s who had the opportunity to go out. He was the first mover in our family's history. And he had the opportunity to go to Japan, where a lot of the leading Chinese students and scholars and intellectuals went to try to build a new China. The Qing Dynasty, it was still the days of Imperial China, and China was incredibly weak. The people were incredibly poor. It was at the bottom. And this was where the intellectuals went to interact with the modern ideas of the world at the time. All of the isms that we accept today, modernism, feminism, Marxism, capitalism, empiricism, all of these things were new to China at the time, because China came late to modernity, it came late to industrialization. So this generation of scholars is one that my great-grandfather had the opportunity to join. He studied law at one of the leading universities in Tokyo. He also married a Japanese wife while he was there, which came as a great surprise to his Chinese wife.
His existing Chinese wife, right.
That's right. So, you know, a lot of families have these kinds of stories, these awkward moments that you have to kind of deal with and understand. But, you know, those awkward moments, actually, when I talk to others who have these same kinds of stories, not that unusual.
And his Japanese wife is actually your great-grandmother.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So I have a small percentage of me is also Japanese. So this goes back to a time when China and Japan were still, had a relatively good relationship. Now it is much different. It has soured in many official ways. So it doesn't really pay any dividends when someone like me goes to China and says they're a little bit Japanese. It tends to be a conversation stopper.
So,
but going back to my great-grandfather, what I take away from his story is he was part of an early generation of these cultural middlemen who took some of the leading ideas from the world and brought them back to China and kind of sprinkled these seeds on Chinese soil and an early beginning of the opening story of China.
Your father went with you on that trip to, is Tong Village the right way to refer to this place? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. What do you think he was looking for by visiting there?
I think the same thing I was looking for. It's, you know, at a certain time in your life, you not only want to know where you were born, but you want to know where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a lot of people in the world, there's something that certainly he and people of his generation wanted to connect with and connect with part of the story and put together the story of, his family and our family. So, you know, these stories often start with someone leaving somewhere to go somewhere else. It can be as simple as that. And in our family, that's the story as well. And I think he was looking for that. In Chinese culture, it's very important. It's highly valued. A lot of people say, well, you go to China as an outsider and people start lecturing you with sentences that begin with "you should," and "you should go to your village" is highly kind of valued and prized in Chinese culture. So I think, you know, my father, certainly that was ticking that box, was an important one for him and for me. I think as a journalist, after going there, I wanted to know more about what actually happened in the village there, because what we learned the first time we went was not the whole story. Mm-hmm. And I went back a couple times afterward to learn the story and learn actually that's the front story we were given. A lot of the initial story we were told was not exactly the facts.
So one of the things you heard was that your great-grandfather had been a hero for the mm-hmm. village in World War II.
Yes, so he studied in Japan, and he came back to mainland China, and he worked as a lawyer. After the Japanese, the Sino-Japanese War, World War II, and Japan, of course, invaded China and started occupying large amounts of China beginning in 1937. Around 1940, as the story goes in the village, and these are oral histories, people told me that my great-grandfather went back to the village toward the end of his life, and the Japanese troops came to attack the village, to kill the people. By then, the Japanese military had been known to commit these horrific, unspeakable atrocities.
All right, Scott, I'm going to have you put a pin in it so we can take a break.
Oh, yes.
And we'll come back with the conclusion to this interesting story. My guest is Scott Tong, correspondent for Marketplace. He's author of a new memoir called Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are @kera. Think.
Support for the Think podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Marketplace correspondent Scott Tong, who has a new book out called A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Scott, you left the story. Japanese troops were in your great-grandfather's village, and he had returned there.
That's right. You know, I'm sorry, I talk around the world sometimes. Long-winded story. But the nub of it is, when the Japanese troops came, my great-grandfather was there, and he came out with his Japanese language skills and his Japanese wife, and he engaged them, fed them a little bit of food, as the story goes, and convinced them to spare the village. That I received different versions of that same basic story from a lot of the people in the Tong family village. The challenge was to try to document this. In the end, could not find anything written down about this story. But, you know, sometimes the oral histories are part of the story. And that was a great one that we didn't know much about before we went to the village.
The interesting detail that makes, I don't know how to judge these things, but many of the people who remembered said, oh, he fed them sugar and eggs, which seems like a strange, maybe that's something that's eaten customarily there.
It's a very basic food, kind of poached eggs with sugar. And, you know, sometimes it's those little details that makes the story come alive or perhaps provides a little bit of legitimacy to the story. It's like, really? You remember that level of detail to the story. The other one was that he carried a flag to signify that, you know, that this village was going to surrender or just wanted to engage peacefully with the Japanese soldiers. But there's controversy about that part of the story because one villager told me, well, he held up a white flag, and another villager said, no, he drew a Japanese flag and he colored it in, so it was a red flag. And these old people all speak with 1,000% certainty. So you don't always get the cleanest version of the story when you go to these places.
One thing that also occurred to you when you were visiting this place, you call it the tale of two cancers. You were diagnosed with cancer in your 20s, had great health insurance, recovered fully. You had a cousin, meanwhile, who was dying when you met him.
When we found our family village, my father and I went there in 2009, and we came upon our closest relative on the family tree in the village. He turned out to be my third cousin in the family tree, and his is a story of great tragedy. So the Tong family village in this small village, middle of nowhere China, has kind of two parts of it. We learn there's kind of the eastern part and the western part, and our family's on the western side. Which traditionally was scholars and some of the intellectuals, and they were wealthier. When the communists came, the whole power structure flipped, and the peasants and the more rural Tongs in the village, they were the party secretaries. They were in charge of the place, and so the people still left there in our branch of the tree became the poorest off. They had the least opportunity. They had the smallest plots of land. And, you know, when investment came, they didn't have access to any of that. And that was my third cousin. When the first day we got to the village, he wasn't even invited to the fancy lunch, the celebratory lunch of people who came back from far away. And the next time I went back to the village, I got the real story from him and his daughters. By then, he was dying of esophagus cancer. And in rural China, there's hardly any health insurance for that. The real tragedy to me in his life story is his father died during the famine in China. His father starved to death. And this third cousin, in a way, he went the same way his father did with esophagus cancer. So sometimes it's a very direct story that really, screams out at you and for me, the takeaway is, well, this is an important story to tell, to remember him by.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send us a tweet at KERA Think. We have Chris calling us from Houston. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. I love your show. And this is a question for Scott. My cousin in March is going to be taking a couple of my aunts and my father to China to go visit their hometown in Changsha.
Great. And I've been there.
Yeah, and you know, my question is, you know, what should they be looking out for? And, you know, if you have any advice for, you know, when they do visit, what to maybe look out for? And, you know, if there was anything that kind of took you by surprise when you visited your hometown.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's exciting. I think a lot of, you know, people in this generation, it's certainly not just a China story, are doing these exploratory trips to try to find these home family villages. I think there are a lot. I think it's a pretty welcoming experience is what I took away from it. Number one, there are a lot of documents in small kind of archives, village archives that relatives and people who live around there can help to try to find. But culturally, I think the idea of people coming back, you know, from another country, even though, you know, official China, capital C China, has had a fraught and challenging relationship with the outside world at times, when people kind of go back to reconnect, it can be a wholly kind of positive and rewarding experience. So when I had both of those experiences when I was in China. As a foreign journalist, it was a relatively adversarial relationship, certainly with official China, and a lot of doors closed and mouths closed when I tried to get information. When I went back as a grandson of China, it was an entirely different experience. Mm. A lot of people who took some risk to tell me about some of these more quiet parts of history that aren't so okay to talk about, they wanted me to understand the story. And I think people who go back may have the same really positive experience.
Oh, my goodness. Your mother's mother, Mildred, is a fascinating character. She's almost a metaphor for the early 20th century modernization of China and also for the backlash that followed.
She was born right around the turn of the century in the middle of, I think, an international conversation and debate about feminism and the role of women and girls in modern society. China was in the middle of that debate as well. China was very weak, and the intellectuals were debating amongst themselves, you know, if our girls and women are weak, does that mean China is weak as well? So my grandmother in 1911 was 8 years old, and someone in her family decided that she should have her feet unbound. Hmm. So like a lot of Chinese girls at the time, you know, her feet, it's a horrific process of while a girl's feet are still growing and bending and breaking a number of bones in the arch to keep the feet as small as possible. That was seen as, you know, as elite and valued and beautiful in society at the time. But in the early 20th century, you know, the conversation around the world was, well, is that really going to restrict Chinese girls because it's really hard to walk? How productive can they be? So she was part of an early generation of Chinese girls who, number one, had the opportunity to run that a lot of Chinese girls did not have. She was also sent to a boarding school run by American missionary women. So she got to read and run. And this is the early chapter, I think, in a fascinating women's story, not just in China, but around the world. In my family's history, you know, her story is a bit of a collision with the American women's story. Again, turn of the century, her teachers at this boarding school were women who were unsatisfied with their, you know, with the options they had in the U.S. back then. So these American women went to China to look for an adventure, and the main opportunity they had through the church was literacy and opening up schools. So my grandmother had this opportunity to interact with these American teachers. It turns out she chronicled her whole adult life in these English language letters that we were able to track down. And so we have a lot of documents about her life. And, you know, they performed a Christmas carol over the holidays. They read A Doll's House. You know, it's great feminist literature back then. She became a pianist. She learned classical music. She was the accompanist for the Glee Club back in 1921. I mean, all these fascinating discoveries that I had no idea before I found some of these documents. And as the historians of this feminist period tell me, you know, some of the early breakthroughs, not just for girls around the world, but in China as well, were in this early period.
It occurred to you, though, that had she had a brother, she may not have been so lucky.
She was an only child, as best we know. And that's right. I'm quite certain that if she had a brother, that brother would have been the one who received the education. Or at the least, he would have been first in line. So what we really wanted to find, and, you know, you kind of look into these family histories, and I certainly didn't find everything I was looking for. And the question that's still out there is why did someone decide in those early days that she should be someone to get an education? You know, it was, in retrospect, obviously a great moment in our family's history, and certainly, you know, pushed the story forward so that, you know, she never made it to America. She spent her whole adult life wanting to come to the U.S., but, you know, she passed these aspirations along to her daughter, and my mother became the immigrant to the U.S. in the 60s.
How did Mildred fall in love with Carlton's son?
She married Carlton's son, and her father was in the agricultural business and in the silk business, and he took his daughter and his family to another city in China, Jiangxi province, in the middle of nowhere China, and one of his friends in the business had a son whose English name is Carlton. And so, as she writes in some of the letters to these American teachers, when they were children, quote, we became fast friends. And she became friends with this boy at an early age. And then she eventually went back to her home city, where her ancestral home city, and Carlton's is from there as well. And this was during a time of, you know, one of those moments of great upheaval in Chinese history. It was called the Northern Expedition. And there was a siege. There was a battle and a siege of the city. And Mildred, my grandmother's father, he died in the middle of the siege, kind of 40 days of starving out the people inside the city walls. And he died. That's also when she reconnected with this boy, this boy Carlton, and he helped the family kind of recover from that. And as she writes in her letters, that's really when they developed the relationship, and they got married shortly after.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Marketplace correspondent Scott Tong. We're talking about his new book, A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. So Mildred and Carlton started a school together. What was their goal with that school?
I think the thing that Mildred and her kind of young women of her era were able to do. A lot of young women in that generation went on to open up schools in the U.S., around the world, and in China. So as part of this explosion in education opportunities for young people and young women in China, that was the opportunity for people opening schools as well. So my grandmother and her husband, They got washed out of their home village in 1931, the worst recorded flood in recorded history, and they had to leave there and go to Shanghai. And historically, Shanghai is a place where people can go when they have nowhere else to go. That's been the reputation, that's been the history of Shanghai, of people coming from all parts of China and all parts of the world to go live there. So they were part of this exodus in away from other parts of China into Shanghai in the 1930s. And her opportunity was as a teacher to open up a school in what's called the French Concession, historically where the French had carved out territory and they occupied it for a certain stretch of time until World War II. She opened the school there, and it was a money-making enterprise. They were trying to she wrote a lot about how many students they had and how much revenue they pulled in. And she wanted to save enough money, even into her 30s and 40s, to go to the United States. She still had these aspirations of going to the U.S. to study. So that was her goal. She didn't always share it with her husband, but that's what she wanted to do. So that is kind of a big story in her life in these letters of trying to make it to the U.S.
How political was she?
She was not political at all. In her letters, she talks of being disdainful of the political conversation. She didn't understand it very well. She loved to read. She loved opera and classical music. And she was somewhat introverted. Her husband, it turned out, and she didn't know this, was quite political. And that became the tragic part in that part of our family history. He made a decision during the Sino-Japanese War, the Japanese occupation of China, to work for the Japanese occupation. So he was arrested as a political prisoner in the early 1950s for that, and was convicted of being a collaborator for the Japanese occupation. So that's a very shameful part of the family history. And in the end, we learned a lot about where he was sent and what he went through because of this tragic political decision he made at the time in the fog of war. You know, there were, in 1940, it wasn't clear which side was going to prevail in the Sino-Japanese War, and he chose what became the losing side.
The conditions in those camps, regardless of what anyone has done, are absolutely inhumane, or were.
That was the hardest part of the story for me to learn, is in the early 1950s, when China was constructing a lot of labor camps for the political prisoners, the prisoners built the roads to the camps and constructed them in the first place. This was in remote northwestern China, the Siberia of China, where, you know, freezing cold, high winds in the winter, and middle of nowhere. So if you tried to escape the camps, you had nowhere to go. So it's not like you had anywhere to go before you you didn't really stand a chance of going somewhere. Those were the physical challenges. And then there were the emotional and psychological challenges. They were subject to these sessions where they had to criticize each other. Hmm. So the system undermined trust among the prisoners there.
My guest is Scott Tong. We're talking about his new book, A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Marketplace correspondent Scott Tong. His new book is called A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Scott, I want to go back to your father's family. Your dad was 10 years old when he fled the mainland with his father,
yep.
But they were not the whole family.
They weren't. In 1949, when at the end of the Chinese Civil War, the losing side was the American-supported side, the Kuomintang in China, and my father and his father were connected to that losing side, so they were part of this big wave of refugees who left mainland China to go to Taiwan. His brother was left behind, and that's my uncle, who I spent a lot of time while I was in Shanghai, and then on trips. When I went back to China a number of times afterward, I wanted to understand his story as a representative of the people who did get left behind. And his life is one of extraordinary redemption, in my view, because in the first part of his life, is continuous suffering. China's door to the world is closed right now. And anyone like my uncle who has family connections to the outside world, to a father, siblings in Taiwan, is politically stained. So when he was young as a teenager, China went through the Great Leap Forward, which became the man-made famine in China, worst famine in recorded history. 40 million people died, so horrific stories of starvation and cannibalism. He told me stories about how he would scrape the bark off the tree on the way home from school, and his mother would prepare it, kind of marinate it, and that's what they had to get by. He talked about the great day when he walked back from school and he found a frog on the way home to consume. So that was the start of his life in the Cultural Revolution. About a decade later, those were the political witch hunts in China, and he and his mother, who was also left behind, they suffered. They were persecuted. He was sent down to the countryside as punishment for children who did not have the right political associations. The big redemption comes in the late 70s when Mao dies. China reopens its door to the outside world. It brings back the education system, and it reinstitutes the college entrance examination. And my uncle's almost 30 years old then. He takes it, and he aces this test. And he becomes an academic, an engineering professor, and he makes this great life, and he's part of the China growth story. He is a consultant to a number of different factories, small factories in the Shanghai area, who are part of the early basic export economy, including a factory that had a contract with Black & Decker to make power tools to export to the rest of the world. So he's a real picture of China, how China was on its knees for a generation, and then things really turned around quickly, and people's lives got immensely better. He didn't want me to tell the story, though, because, again, there's kind of shame in the story. To me, it was important to tell the story of, you know, people who ended up on the wrong side of history. Hmm. Because, you know, very often those stories don't get told.
What sort of relationship exists between your uncle and your father?
You know, the relationship now is pretty good. They went 50 years before they met again. As adults, my father went back. Over time, they established connections by correspondence. They sent letters, and then my dad went back and reconnected in the early 90s with his brother. And then when the first time I went to China in the 2000s, I got to meet him and to learn his story. My folks and family go back every once in a while, so it's actually quite a good relationship. And what's surprising to me is, when my father or I ask them about, you know, how much bitterness do they harbor for this, you know, my uncle and his son, my cousin, whenever I ask, they say, this is just how things were. There's nothing you can do about it. It's as if they wanted to kind of put this chapter behind them and talk about, you know, how the lives that they have made today, to kind of look forward and not look back. And I don't know if forgiveness is the word, however, to describe it, but it's these remarkable moments of them saying, let's just move forward.
Yeah, it was such an act of grace for them to not hold on to bitterness. And I want to know if you think, is that just an aspect of who they are as individuals? Is this part of Chinese culture? Because it seems to me like American culture would be to be very bitter for a very long time and you know, really never want to resume relations.
You know, I don't know the whole answer to why. I think a lot about why that's the case. My uncle often tells me, you know, I don't know why you want to understand or write this story, because every Chinese family has one of these stories. Hmm. And my response to him is, well, it's new to me, and it's important to be told. But to him, I think, you know, this is something that's not remarkable. This is just a whole generation. To me, it's one of the most remarkable generations in Chinese history. But to him, it's just his generation. And so many people of that generation live through these things and learn to kind of move on from that. The impetus is more to not look back, and it's almost as if, you know, what's the point of having a museum for bad memories? What's the point of kind of reliving these things? You know, it's not the way I think about the world, but it certainly is the way he and a lot of people in China do.
So you go through this book telling stories that some people within your family thought maybe were better left unrepeated. And you tell them with great empathy and sensitivity, but you tell them nonetheless. You also turned things around on yourself. You made some discoveries about the orphanage from which you adopted your daughter, and I can understand what your motivation would have been to sort of keep that private, or at least within your family, but you didn't.
We have three children, and two boys, biological children, and my daughter is in the middle. She's 14 now, and we adopted her from China in 2004. What we didn't know at the time was that was in the middle of a very public baby-selling episode in China, in that province, in Hunan, China. So after I went there as a journalist and started interviewing one of the convicted baby sellers who was in the middle of the scandal, he started to tell the story of how the Americans, like my wife and me, would bring over $3,000, you know, per couple went to the local orphanages. And that foreign money, that huge amount of money, created a market. And it created a market for babies in that area. And his family was in the middle of this at the time, where they either found abandoned babies, perhaps purchased them, and they were the middlemen. They sold them to these orphanages that were approved in the international adoption system. And this all went very public in a scandal in China at the time. So the real question was, you know, for a lot of people who adopted Chinese babies at the time, is, you know, how much of the story is the actual story we were told, and how many cases were connected to this baby trafficking reality? That certainly that it was documented in that part of China. You know, how much was happening in the rest of China in that period? We don't know, but we explored that question and tried to verify the story that we were given about my daughter's origins.
How much can you know?
What we found was the person listed as the man who found her. So, you know, in the documents for my daughter, she was found by a police officer in an alley next to the train tracks. And when we went there in 2010, we were able to track down this police officer and found him. And the question was, you know, was this story true? Did he remember it, and how did he tell it? And as soon as he saw us, he said, "Oh, I remember that evening in March of 2003. It was a cold evening, and the baby was there. And he drew the space where he said he found the baby and brought her to this particular orphanage." So, as best I can tell, you know, that part of the story checks out. There are, for people who were involved in the dirtier side of this, who were selling babies, they would falsify this part of the story, and they would make up the name of the person who found the baby and make up the place. It kind of fabricate a story because the babies actually came from far away, and they were trafficked to the orphanages rather than being found locally. So, as best I can tell, that seems like, he seemed to be telling unprompted the accurate version of the story. But, you know, at a certain point, you can't really know. And that's the hard part. Someday, you know, my daughter's a teenager now. Someday we'll have that conversation. And I'll, you know, my wife and I will tell her what we know of the story and try to tell it as honestly as possible.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Scott Tong. His book is called A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. Let's go back to the phones now. William is calling from Houston. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, my question is, could you delve a little more into the concept of shame in Chinese culture?
Well, there's a term in the Chinese language called face, and you have to, and that is your public reputation. You cannot lose face in a Chinese society. So, It is a powerful force in Chinese culture, is avoiding shame. Historically, it has always been that way. There's a lot less kind of social currency to laughing at yourself, you know, making a joke at your own expense, that kind of thing that we do in the U.S. all the time. That happens a lot less in Chinese culture. Some of that, I think, is connected to the Confucian historical past, where, you know, respecting your elders, respecting your teachers, respecting your parents is still something that's valued in society. So everyone has a certain role to play in this society, and kind of respecting people is a certain part of that. So losing face comes at a huge social cost, I think. People go to great lengths to avoid that kind of shame in Chinese society. And then if you have a shameful story in your past, in that kind of society, the frequent thing to do, perhaps the thing that makes sense to do, is to keep that story inside.
Have you tried to imagine what your life would have been like had your father been the son left behind instead of the son who left the mainland?
I do. And there has been kind of a real life thought experiment for that what if question. My uncle is the one left behind, and his son is my cousin. So in a way, that could have been me. And what might that life have been? Well, his story is remarkable too. He's in his 30s right now. He works at a factory for General Motors, and he has made a great life for himself. His income is pretty good. He has enough money to buy a vehicle, and he drives a Buick, which has great social currency in China, has a lot of brand cachet, which might be a little surprising for Americans. I do think about that, and I've asked my cousin whether he thinks about the question the other way around. You know, what if he were the one living in the United States? And does he feel like he has been shortchanged by a decision somebody made a long time ago in history? And what's interesting to me is he doesn't feel shortchanged by that. To me, he has every right to be angry and asking, boy, what would my life have been? What would we have avoided as far as tragedy and shame if we were the ones who went to Taiwan and then went to the United States? He doesn't play that question out. I'm still stumped exactly as to why. But I think part of the answer for him is, you know, these things happen. It is what it is. And, we can talk and think endlessly about what might have been, but it's more important to look forward and think about today.
Are your children interested in this history yet?
Not yet. No, their father's out talking about his boring book right now. We're two high schoolers and a middle schooler. Someday, I hope they do become interested in the story. Every once in a while, when I'm eavesdropping on my high school senior, I hear him talking about he still remembers. Our whole family eventually went to find the Tong family village. Mm. And he talks about, we went to the place where everybody has the same last name as we do. And when the moment comes, perhaps, you know, I can pass this along and they'll get interested themselves.
Scott Tong's book is called A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks, Chris, for your time. Really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director, with Alan Roberts on the board this afternoon. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. You can find the podcast and archives of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.